This is a podcast from the University of Manchester's Jodrell Bank Centre for Astrophysics. For more details, see jodcast.net.
So this is a new near-infrared survey telescope that's currently almost complete in Chile on Paranal, near where the VLT is. And it's a 4-metre telescope, and its camera has effectively a 1.5 square degree field of view once you've filled in the focal plane, because the detectors are separated by a certain amount, so you have to fill in the plane to get a full tile, a complete continuous tile. And it's the biggest near-infrared survey telescope in the world.
When we talk about near-infrared, tell us where exactly on the electromagnetic spectrum that is.
Okay, so it's basically where thermal emissions emitted. So your body emits in the infrared all the time through heat. So in wavelength, then it's just beyond the optical light. It's slightly more red. So it's gone past the red and you go into the infrared. So it's basically looking at heat, emission from heat. So yeah, and it goes through the atmosphere in various bands. A lot of the infrared light is absorbed by the atmosphere, and so it doesn't get through, but we can observe in certain transmission windows which we use the near-infrared wavelengths from the ground.
What does the absorption in the atmosphere for this band of infrared light?
It's water in the atmosphere, basically, and OH lines contribute as well. So just molecules in the atmosphere do the absorbing. But there's chunks in the infrared spectrum where the light can get through, and that's where we observe.
So the commissioning of a new 4-metre telescope is exciting in itself, but why was it specifically designed for infrared observations?
We haven't been able to do wide-field astronomy in the near-infrared before, and it's only with new technology that we've been able to do this. So detectors become cheaper, become better, and you can get more of them into one telescope. So that increases your field of view, so you can all of a sudden do very big surveys. I mean, the first near-infrared detectors of this sort were only around in the 90s, and they were very small. And in the space of 10 to 12 years, we've gone from observing a few odd minutes on the sky to square degrees. So it's quite a big leap.
Why is it harder to build presumably a CCD detector for infrared light compared to optical light?
Well, infrared detectors are made from different things. So in the optical, you have these CCD detectors, which charge copper devices, whereas in the near-infrared, you have germanium and various other chemicals that do the detection for you. So the actual technology of infrared detectors is a lot different to optical detectors. So that technology has moved on. A lot of it comes from military operations.
Of course, you've seen quite a few of these pictures of military operations where enemy soldiers are visible in the infrared from their body heat, presumably.
Yeah.
So this has now trickled down into astronomy.
Yeah, I mean, it's a similar sort of process, but it's slightly different technology. It's more like the satellite technology we have from the military. So satellite cameras on satellites detecting things, so you can use it for astronomy. Which came first, I'm not sure.
What can you learn by making observations over a wide field using the VISTA telescope, specifically in the infrared?
So the infrared is very good because obviously it's at longer wavelengths. You detect light from old stars, which are generally red. So old stars are red, so we generally pick out old massive elliptical galaxies when we observe in the near infrared. This is where most of the mass is in elliptical galaxies. Most of the mass in stellar populations emit in red wavelengths. Young stars emit in bluer wavelengths. So where we have star formation going on, that's more blue light. Old stellar populations is red light, and that's what we pick up in the near-infrared. And the other aspect is, because as the universe expands, you get this redshift effect. And by observing at longer wavelengths from the ground, we pick up optical light emitted from galaxies a lot further away in the universe, where the light's been redshifted into the near-infrared. So it allows us to study galaxies over a large chunk of cosmic time.
So it's possible to see a blue galaxy, young star-forming galaxy, at higher redshifts because the light has been redshifted into the infrared.
That's right.
So what do you learn from these observations?
Well, we want to know how galaxies form and when they form and how they form and how they evolve since they first form in the very early universe. And to do that, we need a consistent picture. So we need to when you select galaxies from big surveys where you're taking large images of the sky, you're selecting in various colours. And this redshift effect, although good for some reasons, it can be bad in others because it means that you're not selecting galaxies in the same way if they're a large distance compared to ones that are closer to us. So what we need to try and do is select things in the same wavelength that they're emitted at, so the same rest wavelength. And to do that, you need to observe at longer and longer wavelengths as you go to higher and higher redshift, and so larger distances. So that's quite crucial, and that's part of the reason we need to move to the near-infrared.
Okay. And so specifically in terms of learning about galaxy evolution with these observations, how do you go from the observations to some statement about what a galaxy is doing, how it's evolved, where it is on its evolution, and its future, presumably?
Yeah, so what we can do is, because we have various filters, we sample, it's like taking a spectrum of a galaxy. If you have lots of filters over the same patch of, filtered observations over the same patch of sky, so you're looking at different parts of the spectrum. And by looking at the different parts of the spectrum, you can knit them all together and fit a galaxy, typical galaxy spectrum to them. So to the colours that you're observing in the imaging surveys, you take a model galaxy and see what colours it should have at a certain redshift. And if it had a certain mass, it would make it brighter or less bright. So by doing this sort of, take the observations and fitting models to it, we can estimate the galaxy's mass and also get an estimate how old the stars are in the galaxy, and also what redshift the galaxy's at. And we can do this over a broad range of cosmic time, because we can select these galaxies from the very early universe and through to quite recent universe, and trying to get an estimate of the buildup of stellar mass in the universe in the form of galaxies. And by comparing how many of one type of galaxies around at a certain time compared to what's happening now, we can try and get a picture of how galaxies evolve and how star-forming galaxies, when do they occur, and how long does it take them to evolve into massive elliptical galaxies and things like that.
When did galaxies start to emerge in the universe's evolution?
Well, the most distant galaxy that's ever been observed up to now is at redshift 7, which is less than a gigayear, less than a billion years after the Big Bang.
Hmm.
And that's the furthest galaxy we've got spectroscopic confirmation of. So we know it's redshift, we know where it is, but there's only one. And after that, we know quite a few now around redshift 6.5, which is only a few million years, well, a few hundred million years after that first galaxy. But it's quite a big leap, because this is where all the first galaxies are forming, and there's quite a lot of activity going on.
Around about redshifts of 6?
Yeah. There should be galaxies out there, but they're difficult to find, because they're obviously distant, so they're fainter. But you have other problems associated with the amount of dust in the galaxy, which obscures them from our view. And also, at that redshift, it's a time called the epoch of reionization, where there's a large fraction of neutral hydrogen in the universe. And that also absorbs blue light below a certain wavelength, which again hinders our ability to detect them. So there's lots of problems, but that's one of the aims that we're trying to find the earliest galaxies, because we need to know when and where they formed.
So the observations in the infrared would allow you to make observations of these earliest galaxies because they are so red, you're observing in the near infrared, and plus also infrared observations will help with the dust absorption.
Well, not so much, because these are redshifted, so we're sampling the rest frame blue light. So even with near infrared observations, we can only observe the highest redshift objects if they don't have dust in them.
Okay, so let's say VISTA starts its observations and video, your survey, begins. You get a pile of galaxies within a certain magnitude range and therefore distance and redshift and all the rest of it. What does that tell you? You fit all these with galactic models? I mean, do you believe the models, or is the data going to be driving the model evolution itself?
Well, I think if we're consistent with the models, then we can get a consistent picture over, if we use the same models at different epochs in the universe, then even if the models are out by a certain factor, the relative difference between them should be the same, because we're using the same models.
Hmm.
There are certain issues with doing that, because you might think things evolve differently. But the models are also being updated constantly as we get more information from the observations, so it's a two-way process. So both the theoreticians coming up with various synthetic models of galaxies, and also the observers that help and feed into these models work together to try and come up with a consistent picture.
The galaxies don't evolve in isolation. They're part of a larger environment. You have clusters and groups of galaxies, plus also there's the universe itself. What will your observations tell us about our understanding of the universe as a whole?
Well, I mean, one of the crucial aims of video is, like, not only do we get a very deep picture of the universe, we get quite a large view in wide area, so we actually probe a large, what's called a representative volume of the universe. So when we think the universe is homogeneous and isotropic, we think it's roughly that on these scales that we're probing with video. Whereas smaller surveys, you have this problem where you don't know which bit of the universe you're looking
at. You could be looking in a very special direction or something.
Whereas by going wide and deep, we get a large volume in the radial direction, so in the depth of the universe, but we also get wide enough so we can sample all types of environments, so from the most massive clusters to the sparsest voids in the universe, so we can see how galaxies form and evolve in different environments as well as how they evolve over time.
So it averages out over this larger area.
Yeah.
Tell us a little bit more about the video survey specifically.
So video is a 12 square degree survey. It's going to be conducted over three areas of sky. These areas of sky have well surveyed in other wavelengths from x-rays to radio to far infrared and optical bands, which means that we can combine the video data with lots of other data to get a full picture of how galaxies form and evolve. It has a depth that it can find a typical elliptical galaxy at a redshift 4, which is around 2 gigayears after the Big Bang, 2 to 3 gigayears after the Big Bang. But it also can find the most massive galaxies all the way out to less than a gigayear after the Big Bang, which is important. And the area is good because the most massive things are rare, so you only really find lots of them if you go to a wide area. So that's another niche aspect of the video survey.
The VLSTA telescope itself has been built. Presumably the camera has been built.
Yeah.
Is it operational yet?
It is being commissioned at the moment, and there are images from VLSTA, and it all looks to be working perfectly. And we expect science verification to start in January, and the surveys, including video, will start in March or April next year.
Of course, you mentioned the other surveys. Video is just one of many surveys that the VLSTA telescope will be performing. What are some of the other ones?
So there's six public surveys to be conducted on VLSTA. There are four what you'd call more extragalactic surveys, although there is some crossover into galactic science. It's sort of a wedding cake strategy, which the way lots of surveys are done at the moment. And that's because you want to combine a wide, shallow survey, which gives you a representative volume of the low redshift universe, with a deep, narrower survey, which gives you a representative volume of the high redshift universe. So it's all to do with surveying similar volumes at different epochs in the universe. So there's a hemisphere survey, which is the aim is to cover the whole southern hemisphere down to quite shallow levels. And then there's the next one on top of that called the Viking survey, which is a 1,000 square degree survey, and that's going slightly deeper. And then there's video, which is the 12 square degree survey, which is deeper still but narrower still. And then there's the Ultra VLSTA survey, which is one pointing of the VLSTA camera and over around 1 to 1.5 square degrees to get the greatest depth that you can over one patch of sky to really probe the highest redshift galaxies and the earliest times in the universe.
Hmm. Are these projects going to be done concurrently or consecutively?
No, they're all done concurrently, and each survey requires different observing strategies and observe different times of the year depending on where the fields are. So, for instance, video fields are only in the sky in the northern hemisphere winter, so the southern hemisphere summer. Whereas the deepest VLSTA survey, Ultra VLSTA, is up around April time, March-April time. So there's been some talk between the surveys to make sure that all the surveys are done concurrently and should finish around the same time, around 5 years from now.
Right. And the data will be public?
It will.
So presumably anybody could...
Anyone can download video data.
Okay. As soon as it is available, or as soon as you've had a look at it, or how soon is immediately?
Well, the raw data, so the unprocessed, completely raw data, is available from the ESO archive straight away, as soon as it arrives at ESO, which is about a month after the observations are taken. Obviously, to get any science out of that data, you'd have to do an awful lot of work, because this is raw data. There's lots of issues with the detectors that you have to be iron out, essentially. And so, but there will be public releases of all reduced data, so final data products from the video survey team, which are made available through the Virtual Observatory. So anyone in the world will be able to download catalogues and images of all the VLSTA data once it's released by the survey teams.
This is fairly unorthodox, right, from you, but you spend a lot of money building a telescope, camera, putting together a team. You tend to want to hang on to the data for a little bit before you let anybody take a look at it, making it public. And the other big projects, they don't do this, right? They hang on to the data for a proprietary length of time, get as much science out of it, and then there you go, you can play with yourselves. Why is it done this way?
Well, it's ESO policy is the bottom line, but it's also it's to try and get as many people using the data as possible. I mean, there's only so much the survey team can do on its own, and we can't cover all areas of astronomy that you can do with this data. But also, the survey team itself does also get a bit of time with the data before they release the final data product. So, in essence, the survey team does get a head start. It's just that when we're happy, and we have certain deadlines that we have to meet to release the data, but we'll aim to release the final data products on the timeline that we have, which is roughly around 6 months to a year after the data is taken, every 6 to 12 months.
When it began its life, VISTA was a UK telescope.
It was.
Now it's part of ESO. How did that work?
So at the time when VISTA was being thought of, a consortium of UK universities got money from the government, essentially, to build VISTA. And at roughly at the same time or a year or so later, the UK wanted to join ESO, the European Southern Observatory. And VISTA was used as part of a buy-in to ESO. So we gave VISTA to ESO as part of the UK's contribution to ESO.
Hmm. Well, you know, of course, the PIs of all the surveys you just mentioned are all UK PIs, which is convenient.
Well, each survey has a UK PI. There aren't just UK PIs. There are PIs from Holland and France and Denmark and Chile, in fact, as well. So a lot of the proposals have joint PIs, so not just UK people. But, yes, a lot of the surveys do have UK PIs, and that stems from the fact that the UK has a very strong tradition of survey astronomy, in particular in the near-infrared with the UK Infrared Deep Sky Survey, which is currently ongoing using UKIRT on Hawaii.
Yeah. How will VISTA compare with SPITZER, the space telescope operating in the infrared?
Well, SPITZER's been fantastic, and that's because it's observing in space, and near-infrared light is a lot easier to detect in space because you don't have the atmosphere in the way. So SPITZER is unbelievably sensitive for an 80-centimeter telescope. VISTA has a 4-beta mirror, so the advantages that VISTA will have over something like SPITZER, it observes at slightly different wavelengths, slightly shorter wavelengths for one thing, but also its image quality will be a lot better because it's got a bigger telescope and the diffraction limit is higher. So we get better quality images from VISTA, even if it's from the ground, because the telescope's so much bigger. So it's very complementary to SPITZER.
We very much look forward to the first results from video and the other VISTA service, so thank you very much indeed for taking the time to talk to us.
Okay, thanks.